This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In reading poetry, it's important to be generous and open-hearted.
We are obligated to listen to one another. And I can say, I don't value this poem because I don't think it's smart or beautiful. And you can say, I love it because it's about something I never get to read about in poetry, which is like making hamburgers. We're obligated to listen. There's not really any basis for argument because we're not trying to decide which is the correct interpretation.
Interpreting Poetry, Laura Kennedy's interview with two Central Illinois authors, plus more of the books of 2017, works on Greenbelt communities, a Holy Roman Emperor of 8 centuries ago, and a look at criminals in American imagination. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of America's greatest authors has inspired an Illinois State University historian as she created her latest book. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Earlier this year, Illinois State University history professor Amy Wood was researching America's evolving attitudes toward criminals when she was awarded a prestigious Andrew W. Mellon Fellowship. That allowed Wood to spend her summer at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, researching her latest book, entitled Sympathy for the Devil, The Criminal in the American Imagination, which is currently in progress. The book examines the social development of a new sense of moral responsibility toward criminals in the late 19th century, which led to prison reform efforts.
And I was interested in the ways in which our responses to crime and criminal justice are guided by feeling and emotion. That crime produces, obviously, a lot of social emotions like grief, outrage, desire for vengeance, and sympathy, even. And that crime and criminal justice can often provide an outlet for human feelings about larger things, larger moral values. All of those emotions are connected to moral values, and also things like, you know, individual culpability, the nature of evil, social responsibility in the state. So I came at that project with this interest in the ways in which our criminal justice system is kind of guided by emotion. And then I started focusing on this late 19th, early 20th century period, which is the period that I've studied in the rest of my research.
So was there a lot of change during that time?
Exactly. This was a period of rapid transformation in the country. You see the rise of corporate capitalism, rapid industrialization, the massive metropolitan areas. And then in terms of criminal justice, you see two related phenomena. You see the rise of criminology as a science, which drew out of new fields like anthropology and psychiatry. And then you also see a prison reform movement that really took off in the early 20th century. It was called the New Penology. And out of that movement came a lot of aspects of our modern day penal system, things like probation and parole that people might be familiar with. So this is a real moment of change, not only for the country as a whole, culturally, socially, but it's a moment of change for criminal justice.
Well, it must have been interesting to look at the early days of criminology because this is brand new.
Yeah.
You're watching the birth of something here.
Exactly.
What did you find when you were looking there at some of the attitudes and at the origin of that?
Well, it's interesting because criminologists, there was a sort of debates that we still hold today, but they were incredibly invested in these debates over nature versus nurture. So you have criminologists who are holding kind of two sets of beliefs. One, they're starting to look at biological predispositions to crime. They're starting to look at the ways in which criminal behaviors, you see patterns of criminal behaviors through families.
So they're thinking it's an inherited trait?
Yeah, they don't quite have modern gene theory, but they're seeing criminal behaviors as inherited. And And they're also looking at sort of physiological things that we'd now reject, but physiological attributes or characteristics of criminals.
So somebody might do some phrenology on somebody's skull and say, you know what, you're preformed to be a safe cracker, I feel.
Yeah, not quite to that level, but they're looking at things like, you know, the shape of the earlobes and the brow. And
so what were some tells, apparently, in that era that you were a criminal physically?
So a lower brow would mean you have kind of atavistic tendencies, you're more primitive, or little things like a cleft chin is a sign of sensuality for them, so that you might be prone to desires and, you know, acting on desires. So those are just a couple of examples. So they're looking at biology, and they're also, this is post-Darwin, so they're very interested in sort of the ways in which we might be guided by our animal natures and our animality. And so they're looking at criminals as sort of closer to, more primitive, closer to animals. And on the other hand, they're interested in environments. So they are tracking criminal behaviors through families, but they're seeing that as both maybe a mix of biological traits and environmental traits. So they're interested in, this is coming out of sociology, they're interested in poverty and bad schooling and that those sort of things creating the criminal.
So is that where the sympathy for the devil started to originate?
Well, in both things, because if they're seeing criminals as biologically predisposed, they don't see criminals as having moral culpability over their actions, that crimes are something that criminals might not have control over. And then with environment, yes, it's the idea that society creates the criminal. And if society creates the criminal, society bears a responsibility toward the criminal.
If there's no responsibility or culpability within the criminal, then how do you have a justice system?
It's not that they don't believe that. I mean, certainly there were certain criminologists who believed that they don't have responsibility. What it leads to is a sense of, what does society now owe the criminal, and how can we help restore the criminal back into society? So there's much more emphasis on rehabilitation. With the birth of penitentiaries, certainly pre-19th century, yes, you exile the criminal, you expunge the criminal for society. There was no sense of rehabilitation. In the antebellum period, the early 19th century, you see the rise of the penitentiary, the rise of what we call a modern prison. And they did have a focus that the prisoner could be rehabilitated. But their focus more was on the prison as deterrence, right? Segregate the criminal from society. They did have a sense that criminals came out of poor environments. But the idea was, you segregate the prisoner from that environment, and you segregate prisoners from each other. Prisoners were not allowed to speak to each other. They're in individual cells.
Something akin to solitary confinement?
Yes, although many of them are in workhouses. So they'd be in a workplace in the prison next to each other. They're eating together. They're just not allowed to speak to each other. And so this idea of kind of segregating the criminals so that they can go internally into themselves to reform themselves. What's different in the period I'm looking at, and this is where sympathy as well comes in, that it was called the rehabilitative ideal, this kind of emphasis that prisoners could be corrected and rehabilitated. It depended on sympathy. It depended on the public sympathizing with the criminal and wanting to accept the criminal back into the social fold. And it also depended on cultivating sympathy within the criminal, so that you cultivate the criminals, you build up his moral sensibility, his obligations to others. And that means that you don't want to segregate the criminal from the rest of society. It means that you want to enhance the criminal's ties to his family, to his community. So that's where you get things like probation and parole. Like, can we rehabilitate the prisoner by bringing him back into his community? More emphasis on letter writing, allowing the prisoners to read newspapers and books and have family visits and have prisoners engage in activities with each other. All of that comes into being in that period.
So all the stuff that we take for granted that we have today, this had to be developed at some point, and this is when it was happening.
This is exactly the period when it's happening. Now, I don't say it's ideal. There were lots of abuses and oppressive conditions in prisons in this period. But what you see is reformers exposing those oppressive conditions and exposing those brutalities and abuses.
So is that how they reached out to the general public? I mean, to work on rehabilitating penitentiaries and making them better places and helping the prisoners, but they also have to look at the general public and get acceptance there too.
Exactly. And that's where the emotions come in as well, because the general public, you have these long traditions of prisons should be a place of retribution, right? That prisons should not be comfortable places. Prisoners should suffer. And so their reformers are really having to come up against that public attitude. We see it now today. But they're also then trying to emphasize, you see a lot of prison narratives. So I'm looking at a lot of fiction, memoirs, stories about prisoners, films about prisoners. They're trying to show prisoners as just like you and me, right? These are people who had just ran into bad luck or just made one bad decision or one bad mistake.
There is a film from Edison from 1904 called The Ex-Convict, which shows an ex-convict who gets out of prison and he's trying to get his life together and nobody will give him a chance. And then his daughter gets sick and he's forced back into a life of crime to help the sick daughter. And it was a very sympathetic portrayal of this guy. And it was from 1904. And I was really impressed early in the 20th century just how sympathetic the portrayal of this ex-con was.
That movie, that kind of movie, there were tons of movies like that. And these are these short, you know, silent motion pictures. They're
one,
very short.
One reel.
One reel. Know? Yeah. There were lots of those and lots of what were called dime novels, kind of cheap novels. And they all depended on that story. You see two different kinds of stories. One, what leads the criminal into a life of crime? One is unfortunate circumstances, society rejecting him. So this idea of he can be brought, if society can learn to love this man and take him back in, accept him, give him a job, then he won't become a criminal. And then you also see these narratives of the prisoner being restored through somebody's love. So you often see these narratives of the prisoner coming out, the ex-convict coming out, and he's ready to go into a life of crime, but then a young woman comes and shows him love, and he's restored.
While you were doing your research at the Huntington Library, you were looking at the papers of author Jack London. Why were you examining those? What were you looking for?
Well, Jack London is this really interesting figure, and he's going to end up being a crucial character in this book. There's a lot of different things that ties Jack London to this. One, he himself spent 30 days in a penitentiary in Erie, Pennsylvania.
What did he do?
He was arrested for vagrancy.
Oh, the shameful fellow.
Yeah. When he was 18, he decided to be a hobo for a year and sort of travel the country. And he was arrested for vagrancy. And so he spent 30 days there. And that experience kind of opened his eyes to the abuses of the system. This was in about 1894. And he felt railroaded. He was not given a full trial. He wasn't given access to a lawyer. He just kind of opened his eyes to the lack of civil liberties. And then he, once he became a famous author, he became very interested in the field of criminology. So I was able to see his library, the books he was reading. He was reading all of this criminology. He's reading the works of prison reformers. And he starts corresponding with prisoners at San Quentin. And he ends up befriending several of them. He hires some of them to work on his ranch, and he befriends one man named Ed Morrell, and he ends up writing the novel Star Rover, comes out in 1913, that uses Ed Morrell and this other infamous Californian criminal named Jake Oppenheimer as characters. So he wrote this prison narrative. And so he was just connected to a lot of people in the prison reform movement. Ed Morrell becomes himself becomes a prison reformer. So he's just becomes this really interesting character. White Fang is playing off of a lot of prison narratives and narratives about crime. So one of the common narratives you get about prisoners from prison reformers is the prisoner is somebody who's kind of an innocent who, through the prison experience, becomes a savage. That it's the prison, not life outside, but it's when they're sort of in prison that the prison, the oppressive conditions of prisons turn them into an animal, turn them into a savage. And then they can get restored and rehabilitated through love. And that's the story of White Fang. If people are familiar with that story of White Fang, who is essentially taken prisoner, first by the Native American communities, the wolf who taken prisoner, and then he's forced into this dogfighting by this white frontiersman. He's brutalized. And then, you know, he's taken in with the love of the man who saves him and is rehabilitated. So I hadn't looked at White Fang that way until I started looking at everything that Jack London was reading at the time and realized there's even passages from White Fang that are taken from these criminology texts. So that was kind of eye-opening.
That's Illinois State University history professor Amy Wood, who is currently working on her latest book, Sympathy for the Devil, The Criminal in the American Imagination. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Amy Wood has also been researching how race can impact attitudes toward prisoners and their eventual rehabilitation. She's also the author of Lynching and Spectacle, Witnessing Racial Violence in America, 1890 to 1940.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. We continue with the Sound Ideas look back at books of 2017 with a coffee table photography book. Greenbelt towns are three planned communities built by the U.S. government during the Great Depression of the 1930s. They're the subject of a book by photographer and artist Jason Reblondo of Bloomington Normal. It's called New Deal Utopias. Reblondo says the cities of Greenbelt, Maryland, Greendale, Wisconsin, and Green Hills, Ohio, were built by the short-lived RA, or Resettlement Administration, as a housing solution to the dislocations of the Depression.
There are many other housing programs, but the Greenbelt towns were special because they were built in the style of the Garden City movement. And the Garden Cities were a set of design principles set forth by an Englishman named Sir Ebenezer Howard, and he put these ideas together in around 1898 in the late 19th century. He was appalled by the overcrowded slums of London, and he wanted to solve those problems. So his idea was to decentralize large urban areas and combine the best of the town and best of the country. So the town meaning the social opportunities of living in community with each other, but also the fresh air and open green spaces of nature.
So mixed residential and green space.
Yes, exactly.
Did the iteration of it look any different in the U.S. than it did in Great Britain?
Yes, it did. I mean, there was Letchworth Garden City and Welland Garden City, both north of London. They were kind of set up as worker communities. They're just set up a little differently. The gardens are more prominent and more kind of manicured. But the Greenbelt towns in the U.S., they are a prototype for the American suburbs, I would say.
Did that really go on to influence the suburban design concept, or was that going to happen anyway?
It may have happened anyway. I think the more interesting thing about the Greenbelt communities is that there was a social component to it as well as an architectural component. When I think about the architecture of the American suburbs as we know them, as we think about them as a post-war phenomenon, prefab houses, and to my knowledge, I don't think there was a social component that was as strong as what the RA had planned.
What did this social component look like?
It was built for cooperation. The architecture was built in terms of cooperation and community. The residents were chosen. There was some sort of social screening, and some might say social engineering involved as far as whom to select for these model cities. They wanted model citizens. They wanted them to chip in and be more neighborly. So they wanted people who would be good for the community and help each other out.
How did they determine productivity, communality, community-mindedness?
They asked. they asked, but also, I mean, there were pretty heavy surveys, but also they were intended to be for displaced farmers and poor urban dwellers. However, they needed a population that was stable and bound to be successful. So they didn't want any sort of risk involved as far as a New Deal program failing. And they wanted young couples with children, people that were stable and we're going to be there for the long haul.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jason Roblando, the author of New Deal Utopias, a book about Greenbelt communities and the Garden City movement, a book of photographs about Greendale, Wisconsin, Green Hills, Ohio, and Greenbelt, Maryland. Who is Rexford Tugwell, and how did he come a cropper based on this program that was so carefully vetted to succeed?
He was one of Franklin Roosevelt's right-hand men, one of his brain trust. He was a former Undersecretary of Agriculture for FDR and a former Columbia University economics professor. And he was put in charge of the Resettlement Administration by FDR. And the way that happened is part of his kind of lore and controversy. FDR created the RA, the Resettlement Administration, via an executive order. And that gave Tugwell kind of unchecked authority over his program. So he wasn't bound to congressional checks and balances. So people were very critical of him. He was a lightning rod of controversy. But he thought that he was in a good position to change the American way of life, built on those principles of cooperation.
And you know, Republicans in that era would probably sniff a socialist there.
Absolutely. And they call him Rex the Red for a reason. And there were supposed to be, he envisioned hundreds of these cities across America.
He didn't last that long.
He did not last that long. It was a two-year tenure at the RA.
This is not uncommon for New Deal programs that became a little too hot for Roosevelt to handle. There were a couple of other theater startups that he also had to walk back and kill after a while, too.
Right, right.
What was the concluding straw that broke the camel's back for Tugwell?
I think there were a lot of straws. I think by 1937, the cities were about to open. They started construction in 1935, and 1937, he was canned. There was supposed to be a fourth Greenbelt community outside of New York City in New Jersey, and there was an injunction to stop that. The citizens around that area didn't want this European Bauhaus housing, and they didn't want to live under what they perceived as lower-class people. And the RA and the and how it was created was called into its constitutionality was called into question. And I think at that moment, Tugwell had just put the pedal to the metal and says, "Let's get this done." But you know, throughout the project, there were lots of cost overruns. He was constantly defending himself, saying, you know, this is not only a housing program, but it's a jobs program as well. We're putting people to work. So I think that's a really interesting take on what the government could and should be doing for people who are in trouble.
Having started this utopia, the federal government owned the land. And they continued to own the land through the final one was turned over back to the citizens and the public in the 1950s. That seems a long, lingering legacy, doesn't it? Tell us about that.
A lot of the businesses were run cooperatively. People in the post office were federal employees. They are federal employees. But people who worked in the theater and people who worked in the and the cooperative were considered federal employees. And people were also worried about tax breaks that they might be getting as far as like who is collecting the taxes and who does that go to. But the bigger concern was, as far as the government ownership, the competition that it would give to the private market. And, you know, those echoes of that kind of ring today as far as how people are perceiving the Affordable Care Act. So these political divisions, you know, are as old as time itself, I suppose. I mean, you can go back to the Roman Senate.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The author of New Deal Utopias is Jason Roblondo of ISU. My impression of many of the photos is that they're remarkably uncrowded. In the images of buildings, they're portrayed sparely and cleanly. When there are people, they're not generally in large groups. The colors aren't busy, but rather in large blocks or swaths. Is that impression of your approach accurate? And if so, what are you trying to tell us?
I had made my initial trips to the Greenbelt towns. I was just floored by how green they were, how many parks there were, how many trees there were. I felt like I needed to step back, both conceptually and physically. And I was concentrating on the architecture, and every now and then someone would approach me and I would photograph them. And there's a handful of portraits in the book, but for the most part, the people have receded into the distance and they got smaller and smaller and smaller. And then they kind of disappear. And I was thinking about how people envision utopia. And utopia is a very broad, messy subject, but I was also thinking about how urban planners might see something as a new start, a utopia as a new start, and how there's always a break where they're trying to bring order to chaos, and I think that's what was in the mind of Tugwell when he thought about these new suburban landscapes, this kind of pioneer spirit.
Having created the order, though, this New Deal utopia and the embodiment of the Garden City movement, you're photographing 70, 80 years down the road when that universe has aged. Entropy has had its way in some fashion. Was that part of the contrast that emerged for you, or were you trying to recapture what was rather than what is?
A little of both. That's a wonderful question. I mean, I think that utopia itself is an impossible concept, and we're always chasing it, and it's unattainable. And it's unattainable. However, I love people's attempt at it. And even when it's as close to reality as possible, even idols age. Even there's an image of a water feature at a pool in Greenbelt, it was a kind of a late summer day. There are just signs of age, and I'm not sure when that water when that water feature was put in, but there are just little signs of rust on it. And I kind of want to emphasize that these things don't last forever. But I love that the spirit of these towns are alive and well. And, 80 years past its founding, there are lots of residents in these towns that love that New Deal legacy and the spirit of cooperation. And this connection to history.
Is it markedly different from any other healthy functioning community, though, this spirit of solidarity and community involvement?
I think there's something special about the relationship between these three cities, that they were kind of born out of the Depression, and they were born with each other. And when I traveled from Greenbelt to Green Hills and to Greendale, there were similarities in a lot of the architecture, but the people, they were very interested in why I was there. When I would converse with them, they would say, like, oh, Greenbelt, how is Greenbelt? And I'm like, oh, they're fine. They say hi. So it really is like they were sister cities. And I know that a lot of cities have these relationships with a city abroad, and then they send stuff back to each other. But I think the shared past and why it was created, it means a lot to them. And they will have celebrations of Roosevelt, and they'll have little kind of retro days. It's something that I am not familiar with in the places where I have lived. But I, you know, I'm sure that there are people who are interested in history and their past in every community. But the shared past that cuts across state, you know, across three different states, I thought was pretty interesting. When Tugwell retired, he was the governor of Puerto Rico for a little bit after his stint at the RA, but he ended up retiring and living in Greenbelt itself. So I think he really wanted to put his money where his mouth is and live that dream that he envisioned.
Jason Reblondo is the author of New Deal Utopias and a Bloomington Normal-based photographer and artist.
You're already in a relationship with WGLT, so let's make it Facebook official. Follow GLT on Facebook and Twitter for the latest news, interviews, music, and more all day long and throughout the weekend. You'll join a community of GLT fans eager to talk about the day's news and what it means for Central Illinois. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. There's a famous book by John Chardy called How Does a Poem Mean? This is not that book, but it does provide a framework for interpreting and enjoying poetry, much as Chiardi's landmark work does. Laura Kennedy has more with a pair of Central Illinois professors who want to demystify poetry and why we react to a poem in a particular way.
Be it in the classroom or in a reading group, we're constantly judging what we read. And a new book from Illinois State University English professor Bob Broad and Illinois Wesleyan University English professor Mike Tooney aims to help us in those efforts. We Need to Talk, a new method for evaluating poetry, reveals a technique that can help readers learn how to evaluate poems and also learn more about each other by discovering what it is we value. The professors began work on the book about 12 years ago, says Broad, when Tooney expressed a desire to come up with a method for getting people to figure out what they really value in contemporary American poetry.
And there was a pause, and I said, Mike, you know I wrote a book called What We Really Value, right?
It's just a book.
I'll lend you a copy, Mike. So, and then the project was born.
Bob's method in rhetoric and composition, he calls it dynamic criteria mapping.
Ooh, that sounds very serious.
It's great, right? Well, it's a great name for a great method. And when people kind of think about value, they think that what I can do is just kind of sit there, maybe I'll read something on my own, and I'll think about my own values more deeply, and I will come to understand them better. And it turns out that Bob's work with dynamic criteria mapping, he kind of says, no, that's just not the case. That what you actually have to do is you have to sit down with other people, you have to look at texts, and you have to discuss those texts. And in those discussions, your values become, are kind of revealed through that process.
So that's something you have to do in a communal
situation? So dynamic criteria mapping is communal, is vital, right? So it is in part that kind of human interaction, that vibrant, that sometimes antagonistic, often dramatic interaction with people where ideas are sparking. It's where values are really revealed. And what you do is you record those conversations and then you analyze those conversations. So Bob and I, relatively late in the process, came up with a metaphor for one way of valuing things is, right, you try to dig deep and you try to discover values as if they're sitting there like entities to be achieved by just working to get to them. But what we thought was value just doesn't behave like that. Values aren't these kind of solid little nuggets that we go after. They're much more quirky and quirky. Our values shift depending upon the time of day. They shift depending upon
it depends on the people you're with.
And the people you're with. And it's completely
and whether
contextual.
You've had your coffee. Yet.
And whether you've had your coffee, indeed. And so we said, instead of thinking about a metaphor of kind of that a process is kind of digging down to try to find these nuggets of value, that What we're doing is kind of creating a method that actually is more of a particle collider, right? So that you have values discussions and the values slam into each other and we learn about those values by seeing them interact and by being able to record them and then analyze those recordings.
Are there universal values?
No.
Really?
Next question. Sorry to let everybody know.
That was a great question and a great answer.
I'm surprised.
Yeah. So one of the other reasons for this project is people either approach value in one of two ways. Either they thought that value was objective, that we should be able to kind of discover what the values actually are and what we should all believe. Or they thought, well, value is merely subjective, right? So I think this, you think that, and there's nothing to do in the middle there. Value clearly isn't objective. People value different things. It's just not objective. And it doesn't feel like it's subjective because actually our behaviors put that to the test. We actually think that it's important to discuss our values and to maybe even try to persuade other people of them.
So, Laura, I'm going to give a quick example. You asked this great question, are there universal values in poetry? Mike gave the correct answer. The answer is no. here's a quick illustration. Yeah, good job, Mike.
Of course.
You read the book. So.
Yeah.
There's a poem, a well-known poem called Short Order Cook. The poet is?
Jim Daniels.
The poem is a description, a first-person narrative of a short order cook fulfilling an order for 30 cheeseburgers and 30 fries. It's a sort of heroic accomplishment for the short order cook. And one of the poets in the group said, after a couple people had said what they love about this poem, it's working class, it's male, it's kind of gutsy, it's very, you know, gritty. And another poet said, there's nothing smart in this poem and there's nothing beautiful in this poem. If there's nothing smart or beautiful in it, what's good about it? So that shows to me, some people value smart, beautiful poetry, and some people value, sometimes, poetry that's about work. As one of our participants said, crappy work. And he also said, this poem makes me want a cheeseburger, and I'm a vegetarian.
Ooh,
so
that's a good poem.
One example of how people value poetry differently, and at least in that situation, there was nothing universal. There was an argument because they were valuing it differently.
So, of course, your book is something that will be used in classrooms, and it will be used in academic settings. But what about us ordinary poetry schmoes? If we have like a reading group or something, is this something that we can use off campus, as it were?
Yes. Here's what I think our book can do for a reading group is it can offer the reading group some ideas about why it is that you don't all agree about which book you should read next. And it might also give you a way to begin to actually even focus in some new ways some of your discussions about the poems that you're looking at. It's an important process to undertake to discover those values. So the point isn't to get a lesson from it. The point is to actually do it.
Laura, I was thinking that WGLT might like to read the book because you might decide you want to help your listeners articulate what they value in their radio stations. Michael and I and a few thousand other people in this community donate money to WGLT because we value local media, we value public media, and we love the people who work here. So that's three criteria right off the top of my head. But we could dig deeper and find out more about what people value about WGLT.
How, in a group situation, in a communal evaluation, do we keep people being civil to one another with regards to evaluation?
Some of the rules of dynamic criteria mapping are that everyone's reading the same text. Each participant's job is to articulate what she values and to listen to what others say they value. If I value one thing and you value another, if I value beauty and intelligence and you value working class, you know, representations of crappy work, we are obligated to listen to one another. And I can say, oh, I don't value this poem because I don't think it's smart or beautiful. And you can say, I love it because it's about something I never get to read about in poetry, which is like making hamburgers. And we're obligated to listen. There's not really any basis for argument because we're not trying to decide which is the correct interpretation or which is the correct evaluation. We're trying, because we're in a community together, we're trying to learn what our community values. Our main job is to listen and to speak and to learn as a community to gain clarity about what we value. And our values do not have to agree. I love pointing to the example of the Supreme Court of the United States. Because that's a body that makes crucial decisions for our country, and they do not agree. They are civil. They argue passionately. They get upset. They write, you know, stinging dissents. And yet they are a community, and we can study their decisions and learn what they value that way.
That's Bob Broad and Mike Tooney. Their new book is We Need to Talk, A New Method for Evaluating Poetry. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Bob Broad and Mike Tooney's book is now available from Multilingual Matters Books. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An ISU scholar says to understand modern Europe, it might help to read his biography of a German emperor who lived nearly nine centuries ago. It's the first such English-language biography of Friedrich Barbarossa in nearly 50 years. John Fried is an emeritus distinguished professor of history. In this conversation, Fried says Barbarossa's importance stretches well into the present from his leadership of the Holy Roman Empire, starting in the year 1152.
I think he's an important character in German history. Various German regimes, at least for the last 150 years, have appealed to him, obviously to justify all sorts of different kinds of systems, some more successfully or less successfully than others. He became a symbol of German national unity in the 19th century. He was invoked then by the Second Reich. Kaiser Wilhelm. They were juxtaposed. Barbarossa means red beard.
He was blonde.
He was really a blonde. Yes, that's the great irony about it all. But from 1871 on, Kaiser Wilhelm I was referred to as Barba Blanca, white beard. And so they actually built statues of the two men, say equestrian statues opposite each other. It was then, of course, invoked by the Nazis, although the Nazis' attitude was ambivalent. There was a certain ambivalence, but this then culminates in apparently Hitler's personal decision to name the attack on the Soviet Union after Barbarossa. It seems to be his personal decision. We don't really know. And I think most Americans, if they have heard of Barbarossa at all, it is in the context of the attack on the Soviet Union. I tried that out over the years with my students, and at first I'd draw a complete blank, and then I'd say, are there any World War II buffs? And, you know, you'd see the light bulbs go on, and they'd say, oh, wait a moment. Mm-hmm. And that would be the connection.
As you point out, 1930s and 40s, but also in the 1860s, he was a big cultural icon. What makes him susceptible to, as you write in your conclusion, that rarely has a historical figure been more misrepresented and his public persona more shaped by legends and momentary political needs? Why him?
Well, it was, I think, a kind of mythology that developed around him. It's not very clear to me that there would have been any other ruler of the Middle Ages who would have suited their purposes. And I think you have to get to, a bigger 19th century cultural issue that goes far beyond Germany. And that bigger cultural issue is that you have nation-state building, in which you are trying to take countries that are not really very united, and you're trying to create, in some sense, a artificial unity. And you do this in part by creating a common language. In many cases, people don't speak the same language. You teach them a certain common language in the schools, but you also create an almost mythical history, and you do it around figures. Perhaps Joan of Arc is the most obvious example in France. She makes a very good Republican symbol, a peasant girl who rises to save France. But she's also good for the Catholic opposition to the Republic because, after all, she ends up being a saint. So she cuts across all the boundaries. We do in the United States the same thing with George Washington. And you think about the myth about Washington's Parson Weems, you know, he could not tell a lie. The whole image, the great portrait which, painting, which is now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it's a huge painting of him crossing the Delaware. Do we really think that he crossed the Delaware in December standing up in an open rowboat? I doubt that he was doing that.
Really foolhardy, if
yes,
so.
Yes, the spirit of Valley Forge. And in a sense, Barbarossa served that same sort of purpose of national unity in a way that no other figure could. It was partially because a myth had developed that he was sleeping in this mountain, or in this mountain. The mountain was the Kiefhäuser in Thuringia, which was of also a crucial location because it just happened to be within a few miles of Wittenberg, Luther's hometown, or a place where Luther starts off the Reformation. So it had all of those associations, but it was also very close to Weimar, the symbol, of course, of German cultural supremacy. So it was that kind of thing.
That sleeping thing, though, is a Siegfried image. It's an Arthur image. It's a Joseph of Arimathea and the Holy Grail image, all wrapped up into one.
The sleeping image. And by the way, Wagner at one point before speaking went to the Nibelungenlied, actually thought of writing Barbarossa sleeping into his version of the Nibelungenlied.
Oh, wow.
That was actually a point when Wagner was doing it. Yeah, there was a sleeping. The story had actually originally been told about Frederick's grandson, Frederick II, that got confused, and it was the Grimm brothers in talking about German folk stories who brought this then to the attention, this myth. And at the beginning of the 19th century...
We can blame them for a lot.
We can blame them for a lot. The Grimms brought this attention, and it came at it, I think they published it in 1815, which was a very fortuitous moment, in a sense, to get to your basic question. And that was, there had been an enormous amount of hopes in the aftermath of the French Revolution and the Germans then rising up in 1813 in the Wars of Liberation against French occupation, that Germany would finally be united. And instead, the Congress of Vienna left Germany divided into 39 states. And at that point, the myth develops, and it's a poet, Friedrich Rückert, who writes a famous poem about Barbarossa's awakening in 1817. He has him sleeping, and he will awaken when Germany is finally united. And when unification comes in 1871, that myth has been fulfilled, and Rückert's poem became a mandatory part of the school curriculum of every German school child after 1871. So you get, it serves that political purpose of nation building, creating from a country that had, you know, been multiple states, a common history, but around the one monarch in German history where you really could write such a story about.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Fried, an emeritus distinguished professor of history at Illinois State University, who's written the first biography of Friedrich Barbarossa in nearly half a century, as published in English. What's important for Americans to know now about Barbarossa?
He is a major figure to understand what Germany is like. If he was invoked for as a symbol of national unity, in many ways what he really did was to lay the foundation, or help to lay the foundation, for in fact the political division of Germany, contrary in a sense to the myth. I mean, in a sense, what he seems to have understood, realized, or simply stumbled into was that obviously you couldn't have a united Germany. It's an enormously diverse country, certainly particularly in the 12th century. And he sort of essentially allows the princes, who are the great men of the kingdom, and who are, and that's part of the secret of his success, almost all of them, his close relatives, to essentially establish order in their own territories as long as they sort of recognize his superiority. And he maintains, in Germany at least, an enormously successful regime, peaceful. Most monarchs faced rebellion. That was almost to be accepted. Didn't occur. I mean, he manages to rule for 38 years without any particularly significant rebellion against his authority.
And part of the reason, you say, is because he didn't have a home territory of significance in Germany until very late in his reign.
That's exactly, yes.
And so he was accepted as sort of a neutral arbiter because he didn't have a geographic interest in preferring one set of his relatives over another.
That was part of it. Now, of course, it changes because of what is in many ways the disaster of his reign. I mean, he's busy fighting the Pope.
Foreign entanglements, yes.
Foreign entanglements. He gets to Rome. He installs his Pope, his anti-Pope in Rome, who crowns him. And the next day, the plague breaks out, probably dysentery. His army starts dying. Everybody,
including, this is a bad symbol.
This is a bad symbol, including him, sees this as the judgment of God. But the advantage of all of this was that a lot of his relatives died, and he ended up getting their land. And so, in a sense, what was a disaster, in some ways, turned out to his advantage. But it altered his relationship to the princes because he now had a personal stake in the system, and he also had sons. When he started his reign, he had no son. He had no children when he started his reign.
John Fried's book, Friedrich Barbarossa, The Prince and the Myth, is published by Yale University Press. Hear more of Fried's interview about Friedrich's fight with the Pope and the medieval mind at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University School of Communication, in this look back at Sound Ideas book interviews from 2017. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from Laura Kennedy. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our email address is news@WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT on WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.